Blog Talk Radio.
Broadcasting from Atlanta, Georgia, this is The Bright Side with Technisha.
A daily broadcast on real-life issues that will keep you motivated.
And now, here's your host, Technisha.
Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to another episode of The Bright Side with Technisha. Today is April 15, 2014, and unfortunately, we will be probably feeling some low temperatures tonight. I know, right? Oh, supposed to be spring, supposed to be hot. Oh, and here we got to go feel like another winter storm to me. But anyhow, on the line, I have Mr. Frank Romano. He is the author of two wonderful books. One is Love and Terror in the Middle East, and also Storm Over Morocco, and also with plenty more hats that he has to wear. He is a tenor professor at the University of Paris, a father, a husband. He does it all. He has so much up on his belt. And let's give a warm welcome to Mr. Frank Romano. How are you today?
Pretty good, Technisha. How are you doing?
I'm doing wonderful. It's a pleasure to have you on the show. A man with
it's my
so
pleasure. Much. It really is. It's my pleasure.
Thank you. Well, let's just start off about who is Frank Romano and what it is that you exactly do.
Well, first of all, I'm calling from Paris, and my primary job is professor at the University of Paris of Comparative Law, but originally from the West Coast, where I was a lawyer in San Francisco, and I kind of had a dream that I'd be working on some of this interfaith challenges in the Middle East, and so I traveled here several years ago from France, where I was studying. So I transferred to France as a student, and I headed as far as Morocco, and I was going across North Africa on my way to the Middle East to do some interfaith work. Now, this was in 1978, and I walked into a mosque, you know, where they, you know, that's sort of the church for Muslims, the mosque, and I turned out to learn about Islam, because I didn't know much about Islam, and I was headed to the Middle East to work with Muslims, Jews, and Christians. It turned out I picked the wrong mosque here, Technisha. It was inhabited by an extremist group, and they wanted to convert me to a very extreme form of Islam, a fanatic form of Islam, and the only way out of there was to eventually escape, which I was lucky to do, and got back to Paris. And that's the underlying event that motivated me to go later to the Middle East. I mean, it was like 25 years go by, and I hunkered down. I was really, really kind of paranoid about this group looking for me. They had warned me that if I had converted to Islam, as they thought I had, that if I rejected Islam, they could execute me. So I was worried for many years, and I came back to the States after that, and, you know, then I became a lawyer. Then I returned to France, and this time I wondered one time whether I should go to the Middle East and find out if this original dream I had, mind you, I never got there before. As far as I got, I returned to Paris, never got to the destination, and I was wondering whether this was a true vision or not, and I ended up going to the Middle East. This time I took a plane. I didn't go through North Africa this time, and that was about 5 years ago, and ever since I've been going back and forth. This dream I had turned out to not to be an illusion. It turned out to be a true vision, and I've been working on interfaith peace between Israel and the West Bank and Palestine ever since.
Wow. See, it makes you feel like you're almost there, but I don't think anyone can actually just imagine what you actually went through. That is so tormenting, because you was actually in a refugee camp, right?
What's that, sorry?
You was in a refugee camp?
Yeah, actually, the where I work, when I go into the West Bank, which is part of Palestine, those areas, those refugee camps where Palestinians have been forced to live in, for many years, tend to be real contested areas, fodder for extremists. A lot of the suicide bombers come from there. And people ask me, you mean you go to a refugee camp in Palestine? Didn't you learn from that experience you had in Morocco with those fanatics to keep away from places like that? And my answer to them was, yeah, it is kind of scary, but the need for interfaith, you know, working with people of different religions is needed mostly in these camps which have become a fodder for extremism. A lot of the suicide bombers came from these camps, and so if you work with the children there in these sort of ghetto areas and give them alternatives to living, you know, and work with them and build schools and give them hope, maybe they won't opt out for, you know, joining an extremist group out of frustration and blow themselves up in Israel as a protest against the occupation. So that's why I go to the refugee camps, Tignesha, because they become like powder kegs for tension in the West Bank and in the Middle East, and that's where I think our work, our interfaith work, is mostly needed.
But Frank, is it just like how we actually see it on the movies? Because when I watch Hotel Rwanda and the refugee camp, the children, they make them become soldiers. They're killing their own parents. Women getting raped. I mean, is it all like that, too, in these refugee camps? Is this really serious like this?
Well, actually, in the refugee camps in the past, there is a lot of truth to what you saw on TV. Sometimes it kind of exacerbates the violence. These are Muslim refugee camps, and normally the women are subjugated. They really are. They usually stay at home. They're not encouraged to leave the house. If it happens to be a refugee camp that's controlled by Orthodox Muslim that have sort of a great deal of control on the family, so it's kind of backwards when it comes to women's rights and so forth. But the reason why these groups have gotten power in the refugee camps is the refugee camps are struggling, and they bring in organization, they bring in food and feed the people, and then in compensation they expect the people to follow kind of an extremist version of Islam. One aspect of it is subjugation of women. The rape doesn't take place as much as the journalist lead us to believe it does, because Muslims, that's against their laws too, but that does happen. The bottom line, though, is if they apply strict Sharia law, then if the woman is not married and she has a sexual relationship out of wedlock or not married, that woman in those communities can be executed. So you have these really very old Muslim rules that tend to be applied in these refugee camps, and so we go in there. One of my friends, who's Jewish on his mother's side and Arab on his father's side, created a theater group there in the Jenin refugee camp in northern West Bank, one of the most contested places of all the Middle East, to work with the children, to give them options and let the girls get out of the house and do something with their lives, like, you know, be actors or actresses and in this theater. And he was a very famous Israeli actor, but unfortunately, and he worked with me, his name is Giuliano Mercamus, on my piece work and my dialogues. Unfortunately, over a year ago, he was murdered. So these areas are really unstable, but there's still a great need for people to go in and work with the people, try to compensate for the propaganda they get from the extremist groups and give them hope and give them other alternatives other than become a member of the extremist Muslim groups that are present in these refugee camps. And then from there, building bridges to the Israelis, work with these people and then work with the Israeli Jews, and you have Orthodox Jews as well, you have extremist Jews as well. Through understanding and through working together, you build bridges, and you tend to reduce the tension in the area just by bringing them together in groups, and Christians as well. You've got liberal and extremist Christians as well, and so I believe these interfaith groups are making progress step by step. But it's on a grassroots level, Tignesha, not through the official government programs.
Boy, I tell you, and I tell you, you really have experienced it all. And we really don't know what actually is going on in America, but except what we could get from the media. And I read an article once before, and it was, 3 years ago, and they were talking about a 14-year-old Bangladesh girl. She was, she was raped and beaten and gagged by, like,
yeah.
You was talking, my older man, her business, which was actually her cousin, when her family found out, they beat her so badly that she, I think they gave her 100 lashes and a public whipping. And you're right, I even took a women feminist class, and that's what we used to talk about, the different countries and everything, how these women would be punished just for that. And that's why I said, we have to be thankful. We complain, but you're not getting your house broken in by soldiers who come in your house to actually take your virginity. I watched a documentary one time, and I think it was on the Congo. Women said their hips got broken just because the man raped them. They said a 5 or 6-year-old daughter getting raped right in front of their eyes. So it makes you really appreciate what you have here. And if you're not, then you actually need to be over there where where people are actually going through this struggle, running around for their lives just to survive. Don't know when you're going to get shot the next day. I mean, it really makes you think. And one guy offered me, he said, you should cover that. But in order for me to do something like that, Frank, I have to think about my family because I have daughters. I don't want to go into somewhere I don't know about their territory and get killed because I have done my studies on international reporting, and that's why I don't want to do it. When I found out, what's his name, Daniel Pearl, when he got his head chopped in another country, I said, no, I don't.
That happened in Pakistan. That's right, yeah.
Yeah, I don't want to do international news, not at all. Mm-mm. Mm-mm.
Well, I don't take these type of risks take sometimes necessary risks, but there's a lot of people now. I've got a book out called Love and Terror in the Middle East, and it documents for the last 7 years. What's that?
I was saying I like that book, and that's why I want you to tell us about it. What is the love and the terror part in it?
Yeah, the love part is all the incredible people I've met in Israel and the West Bank, and I say on both sides of the walls, because if people don't understand what's happening in the West Bank, which is right next to Israel, it's occupied and divided up by walls and checkpoints, very similar to what happened in the former apartheid state of South Africa. So what Israel is doing, they've occupied the West Bank, and they put in Israeli settlements and then separate them from the Palestinians that are kind of organizing these Bantustans, just like in South Africa. And sometimes Palestinian communities don't even have any communication with others because of the walls and the checkpoints. So that has created a lot of tension in the area. And, of course, when the Palestinians are required to go into the refugee camps, then that becomes fodder for extremism. Now, most people, and I understand your concern about going in there yourself. Well, most people, can't get to the Middle East, but there's a lot of things in my book, Love and Terror in the Middle East. First of all, I chronicle going back and forth from Paris. Now, it's easier for me to get into the Middle East than you from the States because it's only a 3-hour plane trip, and I speak some Arabic and I speak some Hebrew because I'm, Jewish origins. And that helps me get by with English, and I've studied the area a great deal. So I go in and I try not to take unnecessary risks, but to do these dialogues, I go into some very contested, unstable areas. Like one time, I found myself in the new book coming out, Love and Terror in the Middle East, the fourth edition, chronicles. I was in the middle of a riot once. I was in a refugee camp where I organized a demonstration for peace in the streets, and that was incredible, and it was great, mobilized a lot of people. And this is in a refugee camp in the northern part of Palestine, but that night the Israeli soldiers, now this is in Palestine, Israel goes in and out at will, went into the refugee camp and to apprehend a Palestinian accused of terrorism and ended up killing him and wounding a couple other people. Well, the next day, I was still there, I experienced a full-blown riot, almost like the Watts riot in L.A. It was just people were going crazy because of this happening. So I put that, I drafted a new chapter in Love and Terror in the Middle East in the fourth edition. It will be coming out in a month. And it also concerns the dialogues I've had in Israel and the demonstrations as well. And yes, we've been harassed sometimes by the Israeli police, sometimes arrested, sometimes on the other side of the wall, harassed and arrested by the Palestinian police. But these efforts are continuing, and I can do this because I'm closer by and I have some experience. But in my book, Love and Terror in the Middle East, I've put a new chapter, and what can you know, other people do about this event without traveling to the Middle East. And so I've got a couple pages on what you can even do at home, you know. At home you can, you know, during Christmas, Christians can invite Muslims and Jews to experience that with them. During Hanukkah, Jews can invite Christians and Muslims. Just experience. They don't have to pray together because sometimes they get nervous about doing that. Just understand that these religious festivals are very similar. And you can, or just have a community event and bring people of different religions, different cultures, different races together. You know, because you know what, Dignisha? The interfaith problems and the conflict in the Middle East, what happens in our own communities is a microcosm of what happens in the Middle East. And interfaith tension and interracial tension and all that starts at home, and we can do things right at home. And so I got a chapter about what we can do at home and what people can even do about informing each other, and that will branch out like when you throw a pebble into a calm lake. It'll wave out. If coming from our own communities, we do this because interfaith issues start at home, is what I wanted to conclude in this chapter and give people ways of doing things at home. Though, and most people can't go to the Middle East, but there's plenty we can do right at home.
We sure can. Now, I mean, we got to, first of all, we got to stop judging. We that's the main thing, I think. But, you know, doing more research, I'm finding out, like, United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestinian Refugees in the Near East, they're doing a lot now for them. They have, like, 3.1 million refugees access. They say access their health services. They have 491,000 students now. So they're really prospering these refugees. They're not closed-minded, and we're thinking of them as animals, and they're not. I mean, their lives have been impacted pretty much. Their reconstruction and everything, it's improvement with the camp.
It was really similar because I lived, I'm Italian-American background. The Italians came after they left Ellis Island. They were like in ghettos. And then that's my roots, and then I have Latino roots, and then I lived in the African-American ghetto, and the same feeling of isolation was being in the ghetto and not being able to get out because you economically couldn't. And so a lot of the same issues about, you know, distrust and instability were manifested there because they were isolated from other communities. And when the other communities woke up, not through judging, through exactly what you said, through research, through understanding that those folks are the same as them. They need the same things and they want the same things, and they're peaceful, loving people. Give them a chance. And so more and more people have to leave the ghetto, and, you know, the ghetto wasn't just a place where you can go and hide and isolate it from the rest of the world. There's still a lot of work to be done in the U.S. over that, but there are measures that were taken that are very similar. If we can make an analogy to what's going on in the Middle East, a lot of Palestinians and Israelis are working together now because it is kind of like a ghetto in the West Bank now, as occupied by Israel and placed in these Bantustans like in South Africa. There's a lot, and the UN is helping financially. But see, the U.S. has a card to play here. We help the state of Israel with $3 billion per year without conditions. And what's happening now is during the Israelis and the Palestinians are negotiating for peace to perhaps allow for a Palestinian state, which would completely eliminate this apartheid state that's been created there. And the U.S. is intermediary. The U.S. is brokering these negotiations, but the U.S. is not doing anything to pressure Israel to stop building colonies, settlements, and confiscating Palestinian land. So we could continue helping Israel. I'm in favor of the state of Israel, but place conditions on that help. So there's a lot of things we could do. What Americans don't understand is whether thousands of millions of our tax dollars that are feeding Israel without conditions, the Israeli government is using this in spite of their own people. A lot of Israeli people are against the apartheid state that the Israelis created in the West Bank and want the Palestinians to be able to have their own state. But the Israeli government, being very reactionary and conservative, proceeding confiscating Palestinian lands even during the negotiations between Israel and Palestine, thereby sabotaging negotiations. And there's a lot of other things happening right now, but the U.S., can do something, because they're using our tax dollars. We can place conditions on our tax dollars, and so there are things we can do at home without being against the state of Israel to pressure the Israelis to do the right thing, because our tax dollars are being used to persecute. And so what they've done, Palestinians, what they've done is just like in South Africa, they have a boycott movement going. And that was very effective to stop the apartheid state in South Africa. And Mandela and all those folks got together and had a very effective boycott movement, because a lot of American businesses and European businesses were investing in South Africa. And when they started to boycott, it started to suffocate the economy of South Africa. And it really helped convince the leaders there that they better do something. They better temper the apartheid state, because a lot of businesses are being boycotted. A lot of South African businesses are being boycotted. This is what's happening now. A lot of Israeli businesses are being boycotted, especially those that are placed in Palestine on Palestinian lands, making money for Israelis on Palestinian land. A lot of those products are being boycotted worldwide. So that there's a boycott movement, which they learn from the South Africans, to try to pressure the state of Israel to do the right thing, to withdraw from Palestinian lands and allow the Palestinians a certain amount of freedom to form their own state. So there's things we can do, you know, spiritually with the interfaith group, but we can't ignore the politics, Nisha, that the politics of this, there's things we can do too, to pressure the state of Israel to do the right thing, noting that many Israelis want to work with the Palestinians, and these are the people I work with. I even bring Israeli Jews into Palestine, even into the refugee camps, to show Palestinians that there are a lot of Israeli Jews that want peace, want to work directly with them. And this is, we're building connections and networking one person at a time through these efforts. But there's things, again, we can do right back home, you know, and that's what I've chronicled in the book, Love and Terror in the Middle East, to encourage people to get active at home. Even if all you can do is send emails to organize a community center meeting with people of different religions and races, that's a lot. If people just lift their finger just to do a little bit, we can make this world a better world. We can. Every individual can just do what they can in their own small ways. That's the way I see what I'm doing. I'm doing what I can. We can make this world better. But some of these challenges seems to be. It's hard to overcome them. And so a lot of people have given up on the West Bank, and Israel say it's an unsurmountable problem. And I think that's wrong, because if we give up, of course, we'll never find peace. We got to keep going, you know.
We do. You're right about that. And we have, like I said in the beginning, we just have to stop judging. We have to get our information, do your research, find out what's going on. It's not like how you're really thinking. These people actually need our help. And Mandela, all respect to him. He was a strong man. He did so much, and he managed to lose any remaining support he had in the U.S. government. And he, by really claiming that he was trying to stop the violence while in fact trying to, I think he was trying to import tens of millions of dollars worth of North Korean weaponry. But besides that, Mandela, he really did so much for South Africa. He was a strong man. Sorry that we had to lose a leader like that. But you're right. I agree with you all the way.
He inspired the world to not give up, because let's face it, he was in jail for all those years. And in spite of that, he kept up the fight for freedom, for peace. And not necessarily violent confrontation, and he never gave up, and he kept working on it, mobilizing the world, the boycott movement, and eventually won out. It's still not a perfect world in South Africa. I met a group of South Africans, and they were invited to a conference in New York City, and I was invited to talk about my situation. It's very similar to what happened in South Africa between the Israelis and the Palestinians and the apartheid state that's been created in Palestine. Well, the South Africans knew all about it, and we had a conference together, and I was able to talk with some of the students, and there were, you know, white and black students from South Africa there, and they said it's still not perfect, but they're still working on it, and they're still making it better. And I got to admire those folks, you know. They've come through a lot, and they didn't destroy the country. They were able to work out a solution together with just what you said, education. Because when we judge people, often it's because it's out of ignorance that we judge people and cultures, because we just don't know about them, and it's fear that's guiding us through ignorance. But through information, we find out that these folks are very similar to us. culturally and otherwise, and get beyond, you know, a knee-jerk reactions, discrimination because a person's different and how they look and how they act. Through education, we understand that we're really on the same page. It's a lot of times religious leaders and sometimes some religious leaders and some politicians seek to polarize us to gain power over us through misinformation. We have to inform ourselves, and we will little bit by bit and find out that, you know, we're quite more unified than the journalists lead us to believe or our leaders do. And, you know, with that in mind, we can move forward and really do stuff together. And doing stuff together, people of different races and religion, we find out that, hey, you know, we're really essentially brothers and sisters. And we get beyond, once we get to know these people different than our own cultures, then the color of skin, culture, has absolutely no meaning. It becomes irrelevant. Just like children when they play together, it's only their parents sometimes that note to their kid, did you realize the parent tells a child, you are playing with guys that have slanty eyes and different colored skin, and the child will go back to his parents and say, I didn't even know that. We're just having fun together. You know, I think that's the way we should be. Go back and learn from children to the extent that, you know, that color means nothing and different, you know, different size of eyes and culture means nothing. When you get together and do stuff together, you're just one as God made us, one, unified under the light of God and the love of God. And we just need to work on that and inform ourselves and get beyond the knee-jerk reactions that unfortunately tend to be propagated in our own communities. You know, knee-jerk reactions to people of other races or cultures, we need to overcome that and realize that those people teaching that type of stuff are ignorant themselves and are trying to use that misinformation for a particular purpose, sometimes to manipulate people. And I think with the proper leadership, technicia, and proper information, we can make this world a better world, but we need to work on it. And I see slow progress, but I see it in the Middle East. As many people tell me, you're wasting your time. They've given up. I see slow progress, one person at a time. You know, one person at a time. I see it. I feel it.
God haven't given up on us. He's steadily going for us. God haven't forsaked us. So why do you think He forsake the Middle East? They're prospering. Like you said, South Africa is not doing so well, but I think South Africa will just, they're going to have to just come up with the real solutions to their problems. You can't dream about the solutions. They're going to have to get in there and do the work. We know that we lost Mandela, but we got to do what we can now that he's gone. So now, speaking of prison, how did you come to even be in prison?
I didn't hear that.
When you spoke on Nelson Mandela being in prison, I was thinking of you being in prison. How did you get to that point?
Yeah, well, you know, I never wanted to be, but you, you know, when you do what you got to do, and Mandela, of course, had no fear about that. He realized, well, I'm sure he felt fear like everyone does. But he realized you just kind of bite your lip and just go for it, knowing that you're taking chances, but you're doing the right thing. So when I get out there, and it was just, I've only been back the last 2 weeks. I was on the border between Israel and Palestine demonstrating for peace. You know, they were shooting these plastic-coated bullets at us, and they can hurt when they hit you. And if they hit you in the head, they can kill you. But people are telling me, you're just crazy. Just walk away now. And I said, but I'm one of the organizers of this demonstration, and I've got to stay here. And, you know, I figured if it's my time to go, I'm going to go, but I've got to take necessary risks. You're not going to see me taking unnecessary, but this is a necessary risk I take, and including I've been arrested in the old city in Israel, and that was about a year ago. Organizing and demonstrating. Now, old city in Jerusalem, you know, whenever you see a picture of Jerusalem, you see this dome. And that's the Al-Aqsa Mosque. And right next to it, right below it, is the Western Wall, what they call the Wailing Wall. Well, that Wailing Wall is the most sacred place in all of Judaism. It's what remains from the last temple that was destroyed. Solomon's temple was destroyed in 70 AD. And then the Al-Aqsa Mosque, that big dome you see, is a mosque. And then you have right next to that, and this is the old city again in Jerusalem, right next to that, you've got a road called the Via Doloroso. That's a road, a small pathway actually called the Via Doloroso, where Jesus held the cross on the way to his crucifixion. So you've got very strong meaning there for Christians, Muslims, and Jews, and that's where I've had my demonstration, my dialogues on the Israeli side. I'm talking about Israel now, not the Palestinian refugee camps, on the Israeli side in the old city. The last time I did that, I was arrested and interrogated for two hours, and the Israeli police threatened to deport me the next time they found me. They're doing the same thing. So I can no longer demonstrate. And they almost prosecuted me and deported me then. I can no longer organize these demonstrations and dialogues in the old city. So in Israel, on the Israeli side of the wall, I organize events inside. I don't do it in the streets anymore for fear of being arrested and deported. I organize them inside in restaurants and cafes, community centers that are opposed a lot by the Orthodox Jews that don't agree with any type of, you know, with people talking about peace. But I go through with it that way and stay off the streets because I don't want to go to jail or be deported. But if I have to, I will. When on the other side of the wall, on the Palestinian side again, I was there 2 weeks ago demonstrating in the streets, and I have been arrested by Palestinian police that have jurisdiction there. But I was right on the border. And it was the Israeli soldiers shooting at us and shooting tear gas cartridges at us. And it's not very fun to inhale tear gas. And some people just, you know, it literally knocks your breath out. And sometimes you lose consciousness. And again, the rubber-coated bullets can kill you. But, you know, that's just one of the challenges of getting out there and organizing people. And sometimes you got to do it. You got to take these risks because you got to make your statement. And there are lots of people that want to stop you from speaking, but you've got freedom of speech. And if they don't want the Israeli soldiers manifesting the government's position of being reactionary toward any type of peace movements, don't really have the right to stop us from speaking, but they try. And we're not violent organizers of this. Some people do. Some of the Palestinians are throwing rocks to them, and of course they're responded by Israeli soldiers when they get shot at. And tear gas, but I'm talking about the international organizers, non-violent organizers. They target us too, which we have the right to speak our minds. But the Israeli government doesn't want peace, and their soldiers manifest that. And so instead of just cowering in a corner, we get out there and show the world that we disagree with this occupation, with this apartheid state, and we're going to do something about it in the face of the bullets and the tear gas, because we're not going to let them stop us from manifesting our freedom of speech. Now, how many times, if you look at South Africa, did they protest and manifest like that in a nonviolent way, Mandela and his folks, and how many times they got hauled into jail and they got shot at too and tear gassed, and they realized they cannot give up. Yeah. If they give up, then the government has won, and literally they no longer have freedom of speech. They no longer can manifest their rights and lead the people to freedom, which they eventually did by not giving up.
It's deep. It is. It's so deep. And it makes me think that before you even go somewhere, that you should get a chance to do your research, because anything like that can happen. You could go over there, you could be held hostage and don't know why. So it's a good lesson from your experience for my listeners to understand that before you go anywhere, please do your research. Anything like that can happen. You could be over there and nobody would never know.
Well, now you make a good point, and the listeners should really focus on this, and this is a mistake I made. I mean, before I go to the Middle East, I do research the area. Some of the areas are very unstable. Sometimes you never know what's going to happen in spite of your research, but you still need to take a chance sometimes to mobilize people in these unstable areas, because normally no one goes there and they feel abandoned. And you work on projects, for instance, there's a lot of their buildings have been destroyed, their homes, and so you try to help them rebuild them on the other side of the wall, as well as replant olive trees. A lot of the olive trees in Palestine have been uprooted to put in the walls, and many Palestinians can't feed their children because of it. They have no source of income. Their entire source of income came from the olive harvest. And so we help them replant olive trees. Those are actions that we talk about. And you're absolutely right when you say it's great to talk about peace and love, and I love you, brother and sister, but the real work is rolling up your sleeves and getting to work and doing it, walking, and what we call walking the talk. Doing the talk, that's important. But then you got to walk the talk, and most people, that's the stage that most people don't get involved in, which is the most important stage of all. Well, I'd be a liar if I say I want to work for peace and then I don't walk the talk. But I did. So, but before I do the walk, I do my research like you suggested, but the biggest mistake I made was the previous event I talked about. That was about 30 years ago when I went into Morocco. Remember, and I was on my way to the Middle East trying to follow that vision that I originally had. Now, that vision I originally had to do interfaith work is documented in the book Storm Over Morocco. That's a different book. And that's about going across Africa. I talked about heading toward the Middle East many years ago and then walking into a mosque to learn about Islam but picking the wrong one, which was inhabited by an extremist group, and I had to escape and return to Paris. I never did get to the Middle East, only years later. Well, that initial story I talked about, where I escaped and returned to Paris, again, is documented the storm over Morocco. Well, that's where I made my big mistake, Technicia. There I did go into a place I didn't know about. I didn't do research. Of course, this was long before 9/11. And most people didn't have these extremist groups on their radar. Most people, as myself, didn't know that these extremist groups were already organizing way back in 1978. This was in 1978 when I took this trip and I got through Morocco and I got stopped by this fanatic group. But I still should have done minimum research before I went in, and I might have picked up the fact that I better be careful going into some mosque. Because some of them are inhabited by fanatic groups. I might have picked that up in my research. I may not have, but at least I should have done more research. But then it was by the time I got into the mosque and the walls were there and they had a guard there and I was no longer free to leave, it was too late. But there I made a mistake. And so, Technician, for the listeners to focus on this, even in your own community, sometimes you can go to places that are kind of bizarre. Well, you need to at least tell someone you're going there. Even in our own country, there are some places that you have to be careful about. You tell your parents or tell someone, at least do minimum research. And there I made a mistake, but fortunately, I survived it.
Right. You're so right. It's no different from going to another country and in your own homeland. You have to let people know where you're actually going. But I'm just thankful to God that you actually made it through to actually tell us this story. So how did you actually get freed?
Well, you know, I will tell you this, and to listeners as well, but normally it's sort of the end of the story. It took me there was a lot of suspense on how I was finally able to escape. Again, this is 1978, just so I can draw the picture, and I'm behind a 10-foot wall. I'm inside a mosque. There's a mosque there, and there's a madrasa, which is a Muslim equivalent to a parochial school to teach people about Islam. So inside this compound, I'll call it a compound, you've got a big mosque and a madrasa and then a 10-foot wall around it, and I'm inside the mosque and there's guards everywhere. There really seemed to be no way out. And in those days there weren't cell phones, and I made a mistake that I admitted to. I never told anyone I was going in there. Mistake number one, I never researched these areas either. Mistake number two, but I kind of got lucky and I befriended the guard and a whole series of circumstances that I don't want to completely tell and allow the listeners to read the book, but it's sort of giving them the punchline because that's sort of at the end of the book when I was able to escape and then return to Paris. That's sort of the moral of the story, how I escaped. I don't want to give away too much, but I managed to do that through befriending a guard and then arrived in the middle of Casablanca, Morocco. We were in the outskirts of this mosque, in the middle of Casablanca, desperate to find a place to hide because I knew this group would be looking for me and haul me back into the mosque behind in the prison that they had for me inside the mosque. And I met a family, very courageous family, in spite of the risk, hid me until I could flee the country and arrive in Paris. And that's the end of the story. Again, it's chronicled in Storm Over Morocco. And there's a new version coming. Well, there's a fourth edition that just came out anyway not too long ago that people can get everywhere. But again, and that's the underlying motivating experience I had that led me to finally get to the Middle East almost 25 years later to find out whether this initial dream or vision I had that got me as far as Morocco was a true one. And it turns out it was true. And again, that's chronicled in the book Love and Terror in the Middle East. And these experiences I have in the refugee camps in Israel and Palestine are all chronicled in that story. And if people and I talked about being in the middle of a riot once in the refugee camp. That's the new book. That's Love and Terror in the Middle East, fourth edition, is coming out in a month, that I'm glad to share people with, and hopefully we can stay in touch over that. But these experiences, it's not about the glory, Technicia. It's not about money, because, you know, selling of the book doesn't even pay for half my expenses. It's about being able to share my experiences with others, especially the original book, Storm Over Morocco, some of the mistakes I made so people don't make the same mistakes, and then the spiritual path I took, just to encourage people to take their own path, not necessarily follow mine, because everyone's got their own embodiment of universal love that they follow. They don't have to follow my path, but I just inspire people to follow their path. And then the second book talks about the interfaith work. That's what I'm doing now. And I go back and forth four or five times a year into Israel and Palestine. And I'm very much inspired what happened in South Africa and other places that appeared to have almost an unsurmountable obstacle to peace, finally overcoming a terrible occupation, a terrible persecution, and that, which is Americans don't understand, which is happening in the West Bank, and unfortunately aided by the U.S. Monetary help of Israel that a lot of Americans don't know about. And so the purpose of this new book, Love and Terror in the Middle East, is to reveal what's going on, to mobilize people of all over the world, including Americans, to find out, first of all, what's going on. And don't believe what a lot of the journalists say, that Palestinians are all terrorists and all suicide bombers, and it's a big risk to Israel to even give them their own state because they're just going to turn around and destroy Israel. That's clearly wrong. And these are human beings like we are, and they want freedom. And most Palestinians do not want the destruction of the state of Israel, want to work with Israel, want their own state, want to have normal freedoms, just like the South African, want to live normally, to be able to not be occupied by another country, not to be subjugated, not to be placed in these communities and controlled by another country like the Bantustans in South Africa, which is happening in the West Bank. So the book really is to encourage people to get involved, find out what's going on, and to mobilize in a nonviolent way to pressure our governments to do the right thing, which unfortunately are not really taking initiative, neither U.S. government nor the Israeli government, nor the Palestinian government. So I really believe in people, Technicia, and I believe in these grassroots efforts, the long-term efforts of individuals like you and myself working together to making a better world. Because it really were the grassroots efforts in South Africa that overcame the terrible subjugation and persecution they were subjected to. And so that's the whole purpose of these books. And to be able to share with people, and I thank you for these venues to be able to share this through radio and television, just helps me to share the story, and indirectly in my own way try to make it a better world.
And that's what we have to do. We have to come together. Our government needs to come together. We got to get out our eggshell and start pretending that these things are not happening. It's happening right in front of our eyes, and that's why I'm glad to have you on the show, let people know this is real. This is not nothing playful. This is not, oh, I went over to the Middle East, and, yeah, we saw songs. No, this is something deep, and this is serious. I mean, we've had our own leaders over here, Martin Luther King, Robert Kennedy, John Kennedy, who was murdered for speaking out. And that's what we have to do. We got to get some more strong leaders, and it even has to be ourselves.
Well, I think that's absolutely the whole point. You know, if more people were taking initiative and doing the right thing, I don't think I'd be taking so many trips back and forth. But we really have, I think we have a real leadership void, you know, a leadership vacuum in the world today, not just in the U.S., in Europe as well. We've got lots of politicians running around, but unfortunately, most of the politicians in Europe and the U.S. are only interested about money, power, and nourished by greed and their own interests, and not about making this a better world, neither for Americans nor for people, in other countries. And that's where we need to have strong, dedicated, principled leaders such as a Martin Luther King, a Mandela. I would say also like a Winston Churchill was one of those type of leaders. JF Kennedy was one of those type of leaders. And, you know, setting the scale. But we, unfortunately, I don't think are blessed by these type of leaders nowadays. And so you're right. I think we individually have to step up. And eventually the leaders will follow us. And if we massively organize, like, for instance, Martin Luther King in those days was a grassroots organizer. He had no political role or title. He just got together with the people and said, we got to do something about this. And he went down to Alabama and all these contested areas and gave people hope because the local leaders weren't doing anything, nor were the federal leaders really doing much. And it was all up to us individuals to set the stage. And then the leaders finally came around and realized, well, there's this massive movement organized by individuals. We're going to have to support them. Otherwise, we're going to compromise our own political careers. And in spite of that, you still, I mean, you know, in addition, you do have great, you did have great leaders in those times too. But for the most part, it's going to be up to us at this point to step up and do it ourselves, organize ourselves, and not just wait around for another Martin Luther King or Mandela or JFK or Winston Churchill or someone to step up. Because I don't see them around. So, you know, I encourage people that even in their own ways, you can organize in your own communities. That's something. Any gesture is more than most people. Even just sending an email, organizing a community event with people of different races and cultures is more than that's, you know, less than 1% of Americans even make that gesture, take that attempt. So you can consider yourself already contributing just by sending one email. So if everyone just did their thing, technician, this world would be better. We'd make it a better world. But a lot of people kind of just bury their head in the sand and say, God, this is just too complicated for me. I'm just going to take care of my own, which I can understand that. Life is hard enough just to feed your own kids and take care of your own family. But, you know, if we all thought like that, then we'd be just separated by walls, and we'd never work together, and we'd almost be like the way it was in medieval world, one family against the other. We gotta branch and build bridges between us. We gotta do that and work at it, and we can see with numbers we're more powerful as a peace movement than individually. But taking those steps is a challenge, especially when we have our own challenges at home, our own economic challenges, and some of our own violence in our own communities. It's true. But we work together, and we organize, we can make it a better world, but we just need to start taking steps. And to do that, we need to be inspired by some leaders. And since we can't look to our leaders as models, we're going to have to look to ourselves, our own spirituality and our own love of humanity, love of our brothers and sisters, and love of God to lighten the path. And others will follow, and not to worry about the fact that we have to take some steps individually and there's no one around, even individually. But people will get the point. When you take those steps that got to be taken, your people will follow. Sometimes you just got to do that and shine and not be afraid to shine out there, even if you're by yourself, because sooner or later what goes around will come around and people will follow. It will give people courage and understanding and love by showing care. But we just need to take those steps. Taking those initial steps, that's the hardest part, I think.
Exactly, because you already see our Congress and most of the other government is already twisting. They pulled in every direction by hundreds of well-financed and powerful special interests. But what we got to do, too, we got to separate. We got to have faith in each other. We got to have faith in our ability to govern ourselves and the faith in the future of this nation. We got to restore that faith and that confidence to America. And like you said, yes, we do focus on our own problems, but you got to think of what will Martin Luther King do today. He didn't just think about his own problems. Yeah, he could have just went on and thought about his son, but he thought about everybody. He did.
Well, you know what, which was absolutely brilliant about him, too, is he reminded me of someone who was really focused on the Avatar. Remember that movie Avatar? Okay, yeah, it was a blockbuster movie, but there was some good meaning that I got from it. And when you got to that big tree and the roots, Martin Luther King, he had his family to take care of. He's got his kids, his wife. But he realized, you know, but we're all connected like the roots of the Avatar tree. Even though the Avatar movie hadn't even come out yet, it was like he was prophetic in his time, as many other great leaders were, realizing that if someone on the other side of the world, 6,000 miles away, is suffering, I don't ask the question, what does it have to do with the price of beans? What does it have to do with how I feed my kids? We're all connected. We're all connected universally. Worldwide, we're all connected. And to have that empathy, that compassion for other people, to make it a better world, because we are linked to that person's happiness too. How can we be really happy in our own communities knowing full well that some of our tax dollars or some of our own people are persecuting others, or that people are suffering somewhere else in the world? Because we are all connected, no matter what race they are, what culture they are, we are connected. And that's people like Mandela, Martin Luther King, JFK. They felt this. They said, you know, I could just, you know, screw myself away with my own family, my own country, and just care about my own. But I feel compassion for these people who are suffering. I'm going to try to do something about it, because that could be me too. It could be my own community. And I wouldn't like it for the world just to isolate themselves from me when I'm in need. But it's not about even that. It's not about doing something for fear that, you know, in hopes that you'll get through the pearly gates or that you'll be compensated. It's because that's the ultimate spiritual unity that we have with everyone. We are all connected, and we can do something about making this a better world. We're all connected. People suffering way away, our life could be our own family. It could be our neighbors, because we all are family, and we feel that compassion. That will inspire us to take steps to make this a better world, and not just our own better house or community. And that what we need for that, though, Technicia, is strong leaders that enlighten the people about who we are and how we're connected and what our responsibilities are, not just to our own families and communities, but to our state, to our country, and to the world. And each person can just make the slightest gesture in that effect. Not necessarily send money, send messages through email, or even go over to one of those countries and help build homes. Maybe a week or so people do that. Whatever a person can do in their own power and their own economic capability, if everyone were to do that, we could bring this together, this world together, like the roots of the Avatar tree. And have that compassion and that feeling. And again, through leadership, strong leadership, to make us enlightened to that compassion and empathy that these great leaders had, not just for their family again, but for everyone, that led to a better world, and that will lead to a better world. But we need to take that initiative now. Even though when you look around, Technicia, and I've been called a crazy at the time, said people saying, "Why don't you just take care of it? I've got four kids." And, you know, I'm unfortunately divorced because my wife didn't really support my traveling and what I'm doing, but I'm close to my kids and my mother and my family. I've got responsibilities, but I don't hide behind them saying, look, I've got kids. I can't do this. I can't do that. I'll just do what I can do. The next person do what they can do, and we can bring it all together to make this a harmonious, a beautiful, loving world the way it should be by taking steps. And I think we can do this, but I think, again, because we're lacking in this leadership, we're going to have to do it ourselves, and others will follow, and we'll bring people together thinking like ourselves, and bringing this world together will be each and every one of our responsibilities.
Yes, and I agree with that so much. And we are, and that's amazing how you said that we are all connected. My guests were just speaking that. And we are physically and mentally. Because the universe is mental. We're all connected with the space, the planets, the stars, animals, everything around us connected to one another. And as the American poet Ralph Waldo Emerson, he believed that all creation is one and that people should try to live a simple life in harmony with nature and with others. And he describes the currents of the universal being then circulating through him. I am part or particle of God. God has the whole world in his hand. So if he has the whole world in his hand, you know that we are connected. And regardless if you're in the Middle East or not in the Middle East, you just have to feel that burden on you. If there was something, if I could do something, somebody just let me know, because it does bother me. I mean, I took journalism, so, yeah, listen to this type of stuff. It affects me in so many ways, and I think regardless if we want to realize it or not, the unfolding events over in the Middle East will have a significant effect on us. It will, regardless if you want to realize it or not, but it will. But
I agree, but, you know, you're already doing a lot just by having me on your show. You're allowing this platform, this venue, to spread across to your listeners. And that in itself is a very important effort, absolutely fundamental, so I can share this with others. And then with a few minutes remaining, I could welcome the people to contact me. My email is frankfro, and all that, and then get my website if you want me to, so we can keep this going. I learn a lot from these interviews, and then I take back what I learned directly to the Middle East, and often from the interviews and the author events I have. I'll be having a few in Paris set up because I have a book, Storm Over Morocco, which has been translated into French. But I learned from the author events and the conferences a lot from the local people making suggestions, and I take it back and apply them directly to my peace work. So this is like a symbiotic relationship, a dependency I have on listeners to give me advice and criticism. They don't have to even agree with me. Sometimes their criticism, they're right sometimes about methods I've used during the interfaith. But I'd like to invite the people to contact me if they will at any time. My email is frankfro, F-R-A-N-K, F as in Frank, R-O, at AOL.com. And I have several websites. One for the Love and Terror in the Middle East book is www.frankromano.com. And then -lt.com. But all you do is put Frank Romano, and then you can put in Palestine or Israel, and you can get all the blogs and right on Google. I mean, my books are everywhere. You can get Amazon or Barnes & Noble, and I'll be having a national tour very soon for the last edition of Love and Terror in the Middle East. We'll be, from the east, west coast, the south, the Midwest in the U.S., and then in London and in the Middle East as well as in Paris. And, of course, if listeners are in that area, they're welcome to join me at any time to any of the events. And, some listeners can't really afford the book, and they contact me, and I can send them the electronic version for free. I just want to spread the word. It's not about money. Some of the money I get from the book doesn't even cover the cost of the trips I take. Doesn't matter. That helps defray cost. But that's all that matters, that I'm able to share what I learn and learn from others during these interviews and during these events, and I'm just so happy to be able to do that.
And that's what we need. I feel like you're one of God's disciples. You're actually here to spread the word, and that's what you love to do. When you love something, you don't worry about the finances, and that's why I love. Oh, let me ask you, Frank, though.
Yeah.
How do you actually like Paris compared to California? Because I think that's where you were actually born, in California.
Yeah. Well, actually, I was born in Oregon, in Eugene, Oregon, but raised in Northern California, north of in the wine country there. I actually was originally a country boy, working on farms in Northern California, and had this notion to become a lawyer, and I wanted to be an international lawyer, and that doesn't happen in the country. I had to go to the city. I went to law school in San Francisco and then finally came to Paris. In Paris, I was a student here, and I finally got my PhD, actually, and I'm a professor here. But the difference really between the two is night and day. I mean, Paris is a huge city like New York. So you spend half your time in the subways. It's a beautiful city. It really is, as you've probably seen or maybe been here. It's very aesthetically oriented, with beautiful buildings and a great history of cultural history here that goes back much farther back than California, which is relatively new for French standards, relatively a new culture, a new state compared to how old the culture and the being and the existence of the French state is. But the people are very different too. This is a big city like Manhattan, and not as friendly and open as Northern California anyway, because San Francisco really is it's a big city, but it's a provincial city. So you kind of have to get used to that. The culture is different. I mean, it's a bit more difficult to find friends here than in California. The French can be kind of standoffish sometimes toward foreigners, in particular Americans. But as time goes by, I've met some very good friends here. And another thing is the administration here is a little bit more burdensome when you apply for, you know, visas and or simply apply for, you're in line to buy tickets to a movie. There's lines here. It's a little bit more cumbersome, burdensome, than the U.S. service is not really as much as efficient here as in California. So you have to, but you just get used to it, you know, and you try to find ways of you know, going to places that are the off hours, so you don't end up waiting in line so much. So you have those issues too. But in general, I mean, it's a cultural hub here in Paris. It's not far from being from London, not far from Italy and Spain. You're really a cultural hub, and that is a real advantage here because you're like in the middle of Europe, and you can go to Germany and all these different countries. And when I say cultural hub, it attracts people from all over the world. And so does San Francisco, pretty much where south of where I was raised, and I went to law school there, but in a much, much smaller scale.
Okay. Well, Frank, it has been wonderful having you on the show, and I'm glad that we could get listeners to know what's going on out here so they will not be clueless. And I hope that I can have you on again when your new book comes out.
We're glad to. The book will be out, and it comes out at the end of the month. It comes out, and then it'll take about a month to get on the list. And I'll have probably an event at the end of June, and most likely in September. But I'll give you I'll send you an email when that comes out. And I do thank you for giving me another chance because I missed the other interview, and I appreciate you having me on another time. And I'll be glad to be able to be on your show again when the new book comes out.
One thing about life, you never know what might happen. So if I can't understand that, then I just don't need to have this show at all. I have to sympathize with I know I have dogs too. Things happen. And a lot of times with most of my guests, issues have come up. But that's part of life. And I'm not going to – and that comes over nobody. So, yes. But, Frank, you and your family have a blessed one. And we'll talk
you
very soon again.
You too. Thanks for your flexibility and thanks for the venue, and keep up your work. I appreciate it. Thank you, and thank you, listeners, for tuning in.
You're so welcome. Again, ladies and gentlemen, I have Frank Romano on, the author of Love and Terror in the Middle East and Storm Over Morocco. Please get those two copies. You could find them on his website, as he gave you, and you can also find them at Amazon. But I do thank you for chatting with me in the box and listening to my show. And I'll see you tomorrow at 12 p.m. God bless.
Thank you for tuning in to The Bright Side with Tanisha.
Come back daily from 12 p.m. to 1 p.m. Eastern.
God bless.